Right. Mandy.
Charlie.
I have a very tricky, possibly sacrilegious, but definitely impossible task.
Oh, great. I love impossible tasks.
Well, you're gonna rue the day you said that in a moment.
I was being facetious.
Marry, fuck, kill. Red stapler. Xerox machine.
Oh.
Or legal pads.
Oh, wow.
Everything depends on your answer.
Oh, man.
If you think this is challenging, my original choice was to do Mary Fuck Kill, Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, and Dolly Parton.
Aaron and I literally did that at dinner last night.
Oh, my God. There's no possible answer for that. There's no right answer. Also, there's as a queer person, answer. It's like denying my identity
it's
to
just
do that.
It's just a buffet.
So
yeah.
You can't.
Okay, red stapler, Xerox machine, legal pad.
Yeah.
Okay. I feel like I would marry the legal pad because it's handy no matter the era.
Okay, yeah. Very multi-purpose, multi-use.
Fuck the stapler. Kill Bold the Xerox choice. Machine. Yeah. Yes.
Explain both.
Okay. Stapler can be handy, can be used as a weapon. Stapler is, yeah, it's smaller, easier to.
You don't need to. We know your sexual fetishes now. It's fine. It's all
right. And Xerox machines are just notorious for being difficult. Why would I want to attach myself to something?
But you need it.
Do I?
It's a necessary evil that keeps recurring all over the place in these office movies. We need the Xerox machine. Except for now, I guess. No one needs the Xerox machine.
No one needs a Xerox machine.
But back then.
Oh, well, you didn't specify a time.
Oh, all right. All right. In the magical world of office work in the 80s.
Oh, in the 80s.
No. You've made your choice. I accept it.
I stand by my choice.
Okay, bonus round. Marry, fuck, kill the three dudes in this movie. Frank, Dwayne, and what's his name? Judy's ex-husband.
Oh, ooh. That's an impossible choice. Because I
the
hate
stapler
all of them.
Didn't foil you, but the dudes. I guess the stapler has done you no wrong.
It has done me no wrong. It's called a swing line stapler. It speaks for itself. If you're talking about the one in Office Space, it's red. It's a very sexy stapler.
Yeah, all right.
But as for the three dudes in this movie, like, no, I can't do it.
All right.
Can you do it?
Oh, for sure I can do it. But it's also because I'm a deeply broken human.
Oh.
Also... Okay, cancel me if you want to. But my toxic trait is knowing that Dabney Coleman is deeply sexy. I find him so hot.
So you marry Dabney Coleman
I
or
would
fuck Dabney?
Obviously Dabney marry and fuck Dabney
yes,
Coleman.
Yes, sure.
And
sure.
Then I would just murder the other two dudes.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Like, I think... Because also... Marrying Dabney Coleman makes sense because he is not super smart, but he's rich, and he does crimes, which means he'd be out of your way anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
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 It's very easily manipulated as well. Mm-hmm. So, everything you want in a man.
But hey, you forgot a couple of dudes, though.
What? No,
you forgot the boss man and the chairman of the board.
The chairman of the board.
Who's Sterling Hayden? So
that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't have feelings about either of those two dudes.
Okay. Okay.
More on that later. This here is the Juiciest Bit podcast, and we are the hosts, Charlie,
Mandy,
and ready to talk movies and
light bondage comedy.
And everything in between. And yes, folks, as you guessed it, we're continuing our office movie discussion with...
9 to 5.
You didn't do the Dolly Parton.
9 to 5.
There it is. Good. But before we launch into the main course, give me one movie thing you've been watching, reading, or thinking about recently. Fresh off of student finals and things.
I have a head full of
terrible essays.
Same. Oh, I did see something recently that was really terrible.
Go on.
It was the remake of Roadhouse.
Get out of here. You saw it?
I did.
I mean, it's a betrayal, but all right.
I'm so sorry.
Okay.
It wasn't my choice.
Sure. Yeah.
And,
how was it? How much noticeable AI did you see?
It's so bad.
Yeah. Oh,
like, yeah. It's, and the writing is the worst.
Oh my God.
It's really, 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 like, I can't, there aren't enough reallys. Like, it was so disappointing. And also, Jake Gyllenhaal has no business playing Dalton.
I called it.
None at all.
From the beginning.
Yeah, you did.
I said, under no circumstance does this man have any right to do this character.
Like
everything about this
oil
is
him up, six pack him up, all you want.
No.
But he has a little boy voice, and it's, and he just doesn't,
and
he doesn't
look
tough.
Those creepy psycho eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He doesn't look tough. Mm-hmm. And I can't emphasize this enough. The writing is so bad. Like, at one point, okay, because also...
We need examples. The people need to know.
So Conor McGregor is in this movie. Do you know who Conor McGregor is?
I have no idea who that is.
He's an MMA fighter.
Okay.
An Irish crazy guy.
Okay.
Who cannot act.
She can say that, folks. She's Irish, too.
Yes, and crazy.
It's fine. Yeah.
Yeah, so he cannot act, and he's just, like, constantly, like, acting coked up, and he's spoiling for a fight all the time. And
what character is he playing in this?
He's playing like the heavy, like the tough that the rich guy sends out to do his dirty work.
Okay.
Because plot twist, Dalton is an ex UFC fighter who may or may not have killed a guy and feels bad about it.
In a fight.
So now it's like he and Conor McGregor going toe-to-toe. And at one point, he's fighting Conor McGregor. And this is toward the end of the movie. And they're mid-fight. And at one point, Dalton says to Conor McGregor, "Oh, be nice." And it's the grossest line read I've ever heard. It makes zero sense. I have ranted about this. I will continue to rant about
this. Oh my God. That's a classic case of like content, but not the spirit of the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Yeah.
They're like,
they're just like,
it's about
copy
niceness.
And paste.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
We got to fit this in somewhere. But yeah, it's just neither the time nor the place.
Terrible.
And like, quit hiring athletes to act in your movies if you want your movies to be good.
Okay, the only exception I will say to this rule is Dave Bautista, who...
Yes, Dave Bautista, exception. I would consider him an actor now.
Yeah, no, and he is also someone who has, like, genuinely, like, put so much work into bettering himself. Like,
yes.
He's not, like, I mean, like, as an actor, he came in as one thing, and now he is, like, constantly trying to... like explore range and like build up his acting chops. So,
oh,
like,
he's great.
Mad respect for Dave.
Yes.
Not
for Conor McGregor.
But you know, I would say he's the exception, not.
Yes. Yes. Agreed.
Well, this all feels very validating. Thank you for affirming what I already knew, but you know, it still feels good.
I walked so you could run.
Right. Wow. Okay. So my is very different. Or the same, maybe. Because I've been thinking about portrayals of masculinity in Flux.
Delightful.
I mean, always. But mostly in the context of parenthood, looking at stuff from the 80s and 90s, I recently saw Mr. Mom for the first time, and I was thinking about Three Men and a Baby and Mrs. Doubtfire.
Oh, yeah.
And all of those sort of thinking about them tied together. And that was all kicked off by a recent viewing of Junior, which, have you seen Junior?
Of course.
Oh my God. So for folks who don't know, the movie Junior
who doesn't know?
Is an unhinged thing that, like, it's hard to believe exists. In the movie, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito are, like, fertility scientists. But no one wants to approve of their experimental drugs. So to prove that their stuff works, they do the obvious thing. You know, steal one of Emma Thompson's eggs, fertilize it, and implant the embryo into Arnie somehow.
Yeah. Where?
No one knows. Guess. Maybe on his large intestine? Like, who can say? Mm. So he could grow a fetus and, like, prove to everyone once and for all that science works.
Surely there are easier ways.
Surely there are more scientifically sound ways.
Yes.
Of proving science. yeah. So before watching it, I was like, oh, this is going to be, like, wall-to-wall transphobia. This is a movie that was made in, like, the mid-90s. Like, you know, like, I just, like, see the joke so far away. Like, mostly rotating on an axis of, like, can you believe a man is pregnant? You know, like, that kind of thing. And like, there's a lot of that stuff for sure. But kind of what was most surprising about it was how kind of charmed I was by it.
Oh.
Because at the core, this movie, like, whatever other problematic stuff goes on, and there's a lot, it kind of ends up being this, like, weirdly tender examination of how parenthood makes a dude a genuinely better human, and also, like, kind of complex things, like how being forced to move in the world in a different body changes your perception of it.
Whoa.
And like, how arbitrary gender roles are. So, like, while there are a lot of surface-level, very transphobic things, I felt like there were also some, like, very interesting, like, chewy other things happening. So, yeah, all to say, that sort of kicked off just thinking in general about men in, like, domestic roles, men performing caregiving tasks, men as, quote-unquote, mom, you know, right. Those sorts of things. And how often it results in, like, their bodies sort of, like, being very physically, like, changed in some way.
Mm.
Thinking of, like, Mrs. Doubtfire also. Yeah. And, like, not just, you know, oh, a man is pregnant, but, like, you know, those sorts of things. And, yeah, just sort of, like, how, like, the different ways that movies are sort of, like, wrestling with this.
Mm.
Always in the context of a comedy. Because, you know, they're trying to still, like, be oh, this is still a silly thing.
It's plausible deniability.
Exactly. Yeah, totally. But, I don't know, still, it's still so rare to see men being caregivers on screen, even now.
Yeah.
So, thinking about this in the context of, like, the 80s is kind of bonkers. So, anyways, that's been bopping around in my head.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah. You've thought a lot more than I have this go around.
Well, you know, you've been busy. It's fine. As long as you can describe this movie in 4 keywords or less.
Oh, of course I can.
Good, good, good.
So
give it to me.
Fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Capers.
Like
not the berries, the like doing a caper.
Checks notes. I didn't see any capers in this movie.
Sexism.
Yeah.
And revenge.
Classics. All of them.
Yeah.
Well done. Good job.
Thank you.
I once again went with a phrase.
Oh.
Because I couldn't distill this movie down into just a few mere words.
That's fair.
Dabney Coleman has Kennergy.
He does have so much energy.
Right?
Yes.
Right?
Yes. He is Knuff.
He's Knuff. Yeah, it hit me. It hit me at the, one particular moment when he has, like, this sort of, like, he's grinning and he's trying to mask that he's panicking.
Yes.
Like, that moment, I was like, there it is. That's it. That's it.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. That's genius.
I love him. All right. May I do this summary?
Please do the summary.
Perfect. I shall do the summary.
Terrific.
All right. Here we go. Summary commencing now. over Dolly Parton's now immortal song, 9 to 5, which essentially spoils the movie before we're even 2 minutes in. Side note, which came first, the film or the movie? Or did they come out at the same time?
My understanding is Dolly Parton agreed to be in the movie if she could sing the title track.
Nice.
Yeah.
What a queen.
I know.
Wow. All right. Okay.
It was her first movie.
So it was the same time. Oh, my God. She's so good in it.
I know.
Damn. Like, she kind of, I mean, so Dolly we know where my allegiance lies. It's Dabney Coleman. But second tier is Dolly Parton.
Of course.
She's so good.
She's the best.
She's so charming. It's nuts. Mm-hmm. Anyways, we see women get up in the morning and go to work, bustling in crowds, getting a last minute coffee, walking past a store that only sells shoes and metronomes. You know, normal workday stuff. In front of a giant office building, we see Judy, Jane Fonda, stop to get her bearings before going in and riding up the elevator. How would you describe Judy's fashion sense?
Oh, like early 20th century school marm.
Mm, yeah, totally. I was also going to say, like, extroverted librarian whose personality is hats.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, or Easter spinster.
Country aunt.
Ooh,
that likes breeding dogs.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Many possibilities.
Many possibilities. Anyways, you get the gist. As Judy walks into the office, we're introduced to Violet, Lily Tomlin, who is mid-complaint that she has to train the new girl, even though she's, like, the big supervisor on the floor. And to make matters worse, the new girl, who's Judy, has never worked in an office before. So why was she hired? We don't know. Extra insulting to the male guy, because he would have at least been an internal candidate, even if he doesn't have relevant experience for whatever this job is. So new girl Judy is looking a bit dim and a bit freaked out and a bit out of her depth, but luckily, like in most office films, the actual work is very vague and undefined, so the entire learning curve is basically just figuring out how to make the photocopier your bitch. Photocopiers again, the bane of all office workers' existence.
Truly.
As she shows her around, Violet runs through some of the office rules with Judy. No talking about salaries, yours or anyone else's. No personal items on desks, not even coffee cups.
I know.
That's unhinged.
It is.
Also, avoid the boss, Franklin Hart Jr., because he's the worst. That last one is not written down. It's just immediately apparent when he calls Violet and Judy into his office to talk about how they're all a team, but some people need to be more of a team player than others. Turns out that Violet trained him when he first started, but now, through the miracle of sexism, he's her boss, relying on her to do all the work of a higher position while simultaneously blocking all of her promotion requests. Another unwritten office rule. Shun Dora Lee, who's Dolly Parton and Frank's personal assistant, because everyone thinks the two of them are sleeping together. At one point, Frank tells Violet and Judy to go buy his wife a scarf, and that's bonkers in and of itself, but when they later see Dora Lee leave Frank's office while wearing that scarf, they take it as, like, foolproof. This particularly triggers Judy, since her husband just ran off with his secretary, so she's understandably a little bit extra peeved. Still. Like, no excuse to be rude to Dolly.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Somebody should ask Dora Lee what's going on.
That's right!
Yeah.
Also, then we're shown a scene where Frank calls Dorley into his office to variously ogle, proposition, coerce, and attempt to assault her. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, only funny because she's so good at eluding him and making him the fool, insulting him while he's trying to seduce her.
Yeah.
But really, really, her life sucks.
Yes.
Trapped between a creep of a boss and coworkers who are hostile to her for supposedly selling out, and then also, like, the boss's wife who walks in on them, and mm-hmm. then it's, like, wildly condescending to Dora Lee for no reason. It's mm-hmm. nuts. So that's the setup. Judy getting her feet under her at the new job, becoming office besties with super confident Violet, and hating on the boss's hot secretary, Dora Lee. Things soon get shaken up, though, when, in a 1-2 punch, Frank passes Violet up for a promotion again and passes off her idea for efficiency measures as his own. Violet loses it at him, saying she doesn't have to take his bullshit because she isn't sleeping with him, unlike Dora Lee the snoot. So now Dora Lee knows why the office hates her, and she also loses it at Frank. Not to be left out, Judy gets mad when an employee is fired on the spot for talking about salaries. So all three women storm out and go day drinking at Charlie's Bar, which is really swanky place, if I say so myself.
A very swanky place.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Drinks at Charlie's leads to smoking pot at Dora Lee's house, and soon our three heroes are fast friends with the kind of immediacy that only happens when coworkers all hate their boss.
It's true.
While High, Judy, Violet, and Dora Lee trade descriptions of their workplace revenge fantasies, and we see each play out in these heightened dreamlike scenarios. So Judy tracks and shoots Franklin as he runs frightened in the darkened office. Dora Lee reverses her own dynamic so that she's the predatory boss and Franklin is her PA. And Violet becomes this, like, murderous Snow White who first poisons Frank and then tosses him out of his office window with the help of Kirkland Brand Disney illustrations. Mm-hmm. At the office the next morning, Violet accidentally does put rat poison in Frank's coffee, but he never gets a chance to drink it since his chair collapses under him. And he bonks his head in the fall. When he's rushed to the hospital, Violet realizes her mistake, freaks out, and goes to the hospital after him. Turns out, old Frank is fine, just a wee bit concussed, but Violet overhears a cop and a doctor talking about how someone else just died of poisoning, and she panics, thinking that she's now a murderer. And it's all playing out like it did in her revenge fantasy. So naturally, she then impersonates a doctor,
sure,
steals the corpse, and stuffs it in the trunk of her car, forcing Judy and Violet along for the ride. Only when they get into an accident do the women realize their mistake. The stiff is not their boss. So they return the corpse to the hospital, leaving it in the bathroom, which results in one of my favorite moments of all time.
The best line.
Do you remember? Do you want to say it?
You go ahead. You go ahead.
So when the body is discovered in the bathroom by hospital staff, the woman who discovers it just, like, looks over her shoulder and is like, "Hey, Vera, we got another stiff in the John." And I so very much need there to be a spinoff that follows these women around.
Yes. The things they have seen.
The horrors. Oh, my God. So, new plan is to show up at work the next morning, pretending nothing has happened, and acting surprised when it's announced that Frank is dead from poison. but they don't prepare for what actually happens. Frank showing up completely fine. Only as our heroes debrief in the washroom afterwards, the office snitch overhears them and immediately takes the goss to Frank, who in turn decides to use the fake murder slash corpse kidnapping to coerce Dora Lee into sleeping with him. But instead of caving, she hog-ties him with a phone cord.
As one would.
When Dora Lee tells Judy to watch Frank so she can let Violet know about this new wrinkle, Judy first lets him go free and then shoots him with Dora Lee's purse gun, or shoots at him with Dora Lee's purse gun. Right. She doesn't actually, you know, do damage. Just a little bit of trauma. Now all three women have got to enact their revenge fantasies a little bit. May we all be so lucky. Mm-hmm. The women take Frank back to his house, which is empty because his wife is away on the longest vacation ever, where they tie him up and brainstorm what to do. Eventually, they realize that Frank was doing a wee bit of embezzlement, so they just have to get proof, and then they can use his embezzlement as leverage to keep him from going to the cops on them. It's really very convoluted. The only problem is that, due to, you know, something clerical, head office can't send them what they need for another 6 weeks. Let me tell you, jumping from a little light kidnapping, which, I mean, is it even kidnapping? If you're in your own house in your jammies and someone is bringing you food.
Oh, that sounds great.
That's like a holiday to me.
Yeah.
a little light kidnapping to like 6 weeks of holding someone captive is like an insane leap. But, you know, our heroes make it seem like the most logical step.
They do.
And I'm not even talking about the criminality of it. Like, it's just, like, the work. The logistics.
Yeah.
Having to feed someone else for 6 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
While also holding down a full-time job and, like, taking care of family and whatever, whatever.
Yeah, one of them is staying overnight. Yeah. Making, like,
an insane amount of work.
Oh,
my God.
So much.
Such dedication, these men.
Yeah, he does not deserve it.
He does not deserve it. Yeah, so then we have a sequence in which the women all go to work, initially just covering for Frank, but eventually making some radical changes to company policy and practice in his name. So we get some job sharing, we get some part-time options, some flexible hours, a daycare center, and even personal items allowed on desks. The most extreme of all.
How do they deal?
I don't know. Before the 6 weeks is up, however, Frank's wife comes home early from vacation. Truly only a choice someone who doesn't have to work for a living would make.
Mm-hmm.
And frees him, which gives him time to cover up his embezzlement before the proof can arrive that would, like, you know, implicate him. Back at work, he corrals our three heroes and once again threatens to call the cops on them when the chairman of the board shows up. Colonel Sanders himself.
Totally.
Mr. Chairman just pops by to congratulate Frank on his incredible success. In the last 6 weeks, alone, productivity is up 20%. And through such innovative projects. Frank is very happy to own the success, but otherwise has no idea what the chairman is talking about. So Violet has to walk him through the changes and show him around the new spaces. And then, in light of Frank's genius and dedication to the company, the chairman tells him he's being promoted to run the Brazil branch. So off Frank is bundled to the Amazonian rainforest, and then Violet is promoted VP in his place. And everyone is happy little workers forever. The end.
Hooray.
The end. What an absolutely unhinged movie.
It's so complex.
Yeah.
Given that it still has, you know, pretty established comic tropes, including like comedy of errors type thing.
Yeah.
But it's so complex. I love it. It's just like the acts are very full. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on.
There's so much going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when I first saw this a while ago, had just enjoyed it as like a light comedy without acknowledging the complexities and the absurdities at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, this is like a very complicated movie.
Yeah.
While also being like a deeply silly movie.
Mm-hmm.
And a very serious movie at the same time. Like, it sort of like has its cake and eats it too.
And in many ways, it's timeless. Like, it is, I was really struck on this watch that offices still operate this way.
Well, this is the thing. Like, all the things that, like, the workers wanted for, like flexible scheduling and, like, part-time options and, what is it, like, job sharing. Like, those are literally, like, basic things that, like, we're all still fighting for.
Yeah.
Like, still.
Including, you know, working from home a couple days a week or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that stuff. The whole idea that it's women's jobs to fix men's mistakes at work, calling women at work girls.
Yeah.
I can't even tell you how many times I've been called a girl by grown-ass men. So many of those little micro and macro aggressions toward non-men in the workplace is it's still so bad. And I really recognized a place I used to work in this.
Oh, really?
Where it was just harassment nonstop. And like to the point where I was asked not to sue. These kinds of things.
Whoa.
Yeah. So it's I just kept picturing like my old ass white man boss who would always ask his girl to sit and take a letter. In his office.
Gross.
It was very gross. Yeah.
That's vile.
Yeah.
It's just astonishing. Like thinking about last time talking about Office Space, and then thinking even further back about like, yeah, the Melville short story was written in the mid 1800s. Like how capitalism has sort of like frozen us in time, really. Like these things are still so, like, all the technology advancements and all of the things that have happened over the last 150 years. And yes, like, the dynamics of the work, like, remain unchanged, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. And just the placing of such importance on binary gendered thinking in the workplace, right? Like, at one point, Hart says, he's talking to Violet and Judy about teamwork, And he basically says, well, girls don't understand teamwork because they never had the chance to play football. And then he starts explaining football, and it's just like, what? Like, that's... What? But he's earnest about it. Like, he's very sincere. Mm-hmm. Even though he's otherwise just a piece of shit. But, yeah.
It's like, so you think that the women in your employ who navigate a million things in their personal life and professional life are at a detriment because they didn't do one team sport in high school, so therefore don't understand teamwork.
And yet, when he tells Violet that she doesn't get the promotion, one of the reasons, besides the company needs a man in this position, and that clients would rather deal with a man on numbers stuff, is that he has kids. Meanwhile, Violet is a single mother with four children.
Yeah.
She's a widow. And so she's like, how can he need this job like, more than me? Fuck? Like, that's...
Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously these excuses are nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that this man with children needs a leg up, while this woman with children can just, you know, make do.
I think the implication there, right, is that it's just a non-starter. Like, she's not going to go anywhere anyways.
Totally.
So there's just, like, no point in doing anything for her.
Yeah, and I would even go so far as to say implicit in that is telling her essentially she needs a man to support her.
Yeah.
Like, she can't do it herself, even though we see in a previous scene... She installs a garage door opener. She has a good relationship with her son.
Mm-hmm.
She's kind of doing all the parenting and still finding some sort of balance in life.
Yeah.
And so the irony is very palpable, and I don't think it's overdone or cheesy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's infuriating.
Yeah. I mean, it keeps getting broader to the point where, like, you immediately see his, like, hypocrisy in that moment, but then it sort of, like, keeps rippling out and getting, like, larger and larger so that, like, you know, ultimately, like, the women are running the company.
Yeah.
And pretending handily. That it's him. Yeah. Doing way better. Production up 20%, whatever, in his absence. And he's the one who thinks that he's going to be missed.
Yeah.
At the office, and turns out, like, literally no one even notices that he's gone.
Yeah, except for Roz.
Except for the buttlicker Roz, yeah. And, yeah, she's a piece of work of herself, so.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about, actually, Roz for a hot second. Okay.
I do think...
So I didn't mention Roz, really, in the summary, but, like, Roz is the, I mean, I guess, like... It's weird to parse the hierarchy of the office, because it seems that she's sort of like Frank's number two, but like Violet also kind of is that?
I think Violet, yeah, she seems to be Frank's administrative assistant, like just administrating the vice president stuff. Violet seems to be more of an office manager. And then Doralee seems to be his personal assistant.
Right, okay.
So...
See, this is where I always get hung up on, like, office titles. Those all just sound like the same thing to me.
Yeah. We get the sense that, I mean, Roz kind of has a snooty self-importance about her, and I think she seems to be above Violet in the hierarchy, or at least
like, she can tell Violet what to do.
But Violet also, like, runs away from her and has some hilarious lines about how she avoids Roz's memos. But I think Roz is so interesting.
She knows where to put them. Yeah.
She knows where to stick them. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Roz serves as this mouthpiece for male authority and really presents this tension between women, which I think the film also does a lot with, sort of like divided, we can do nothing. Because, I mean, we see this with Judy and Doralee and the rest of the office women, but Roz is the one who's like, she listens for gossip in the bathroom so she can tell the boss, and she enforces these ridiculous rules, like no plants or photos or coffee cups on your desk. So she seems to me representative of the movie's careful consideration of of character in that it's not just all men bad, all women good.
Yeah.
Which is great. Accurate. But yeah, a lot of movies
some women
don't,
are terrible.
Don't do that. So
yeah, for real. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it really gets at the hierarchy of how, like, proximity to power,
yes,
like, can sort of, like, shift your allegiance.
For sure.
So Roz being sort of, like, that much closer to Frank, in the hierarchy or in authority, like, she then feels like she's, you know, more in league with him, mm-hmm, than, like, essentially just being, like, one of the workers.
Yeah.
And so that then makes her feel like, because her allegiance is different, she can, like, rat out people.
Yeah.
And sort of, like, sneak her way into circles that he doesn't have access to, and mm-hmm, sort of be his, like, eyes and ears there.
Yeah.
And report back.
Which means, I mean, she and Frank are very aware that a lot of information sharing goes on in the restroom, mm-hmm, right? So it's almost a betrayal,
mm-hmm, right? Because it's such a vulnerable space. It's,
yeah,
such an intimate,
such a
space,
private space.
Yeah.
And so we do see her narking on this one woman who wants to talk about salary, and she gets fired. Mm-hmm. And she's also in there when Violet and Doralee, yeah, and Judy are talking about the poisoning.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, she is an extension of Frank, mm-hmm, for the purpose of having that little tiny bit of extra power.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think
Frank, but it's so tiny.
Yeah,
like, it's like negligible to anyone like else.
Like,
but
Frank doesn't seem to really care about her,
no,
having power. He doesn't treat her well. He just maybe gives her more authority than a couple other people.
The only difference I could tell in the movie itself was that he never asks her to get him coffee.
Yes.
And he asks,
one, yeah,
literally everyone else to get, mm-hmm, him coffee, regardless. Like, he asks Violet, he asks, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm.
Well, and Violet even says, you know, she hates when Doralee has to go away because then she's the one he calls for coffee. Mm-hmm. Even though, yeah, she trained him. She's kind of,
yeah,
the boss. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, it's... Getting coffee is sort of an offensive task. Only slightly less offensive than asking somebody to go get a gift for your wife.
Or asking them to go fill up your car
with gas. Or go fill up your
car
with gas. Yeah.
Unhinged.
Or asking them to accompany you to a conference that does not exist.
That doesn't exist.
Which, at one point, Doralee... So Frank has invited Doralee to this conference in the past, and there was no conference, and Doralee says, next time I'll just have to make sure there's a convention going on.
Like, yeah.
So she is aware of what, mm-hmm, happened, but she's taking it upon herself, like, oh, silly me, I should have checked.
Yeah, totally.
You know, to try to kind of diffuse the situation, mm-hmm, which is that sort of emotional labor that the movie brings to our attention too, is that,
yeah,
she needs the,
she's
job,
doing that constantly.
Yeah, she,
yeah,
can't just tell him,
yeah,
to go away or tell him to stop harassing her because she can't get fired.
Yeah.
She doesn't, her husband's a musician. So she needs this job. So she just has to sort of pretend to be nice and accepting, and how many of us have been in that position before? Like, all of us?
Yeah. 100%.
So, yeah.
Of non-men.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's bonkers. It's bonkers. Should we talk about Frank as the boss? Or
sure.
What do you think?
Yeah.
Actually, I didn't ask you. What things do you want to talk about still?
Oh. Frank as the boss is cool. I do want to talk a bit about Doralee's husband.
Oh, yeah.
Because we only see him in one scene, but I think it's really noteworthy that she's coming home to him and kind of complaining about why, like, she doesn't understand why everyone hates her. She eats lunch by herself. It's so sad. Mm-hmm. And he basically just says, oh, it's just the other women are jealous of you. Mm-hmm. You just need to smile, which is infuriating. And basically, he tries to distract her with sex.
Yeah.
So he's like, oh, just smile for me. Where's my smile? And she's heartbroken. She's... Mm-hmm. She has to go to a job every day where everyone looks at her and talks about her and won't sit with her. And she has no idea why. And she works with a guy who's constantly trying to assault her. And her husband is sitting on their bed. So, again, a space of privacy, of intimacy. And he's just trying to get his as well. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. She can't escape it.
Yeah.
And the only saving grace is that he's on the road a lot so she can finally have friends over to smoke a J in her living room. Like, that's... and feed them his food that he made.
Yeah. I was going to say, like all of the men that we see in this movie are really not great. Oh, like, terrible. Judy's ex-husband...
Oh, he's a stalker.
Is a stalker.
Yes.
I mean... a Flanderer, no good rascal, initially. And then, yeah, it turns out that he's actually been following her for days mm-hmm. and lurking outside of Frank's house, just watching her.
Which, like, how did he even know she was going to be there?
Yeah.
Like.
Oh, he followed her from work, I think.
He followed her from work. But, that's like, right. He doesn't know whose house that is. Yeah, like, no. He assumes she's
exactly.
having an affair, which is like. You did. Why? Like, why? You can't be mad at her. And they're divorced. Like, they're officially divorced.
But he just assumes that she'll, like, be so ecstatic to take him back.
Yeah.
And that, like, you know, all he has to do is literally show the teeniest little bit of interest.
Yeah.
And she'll jump at him.
Yeah. Does he even apologize to her?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
No.
He's like, oh, it didn't work out, and oh...
Yeah.
This was a terrible experience for me.
For me.
And so again, like, Judy, Dorley, they all have to fix, or men are expecting them to fix
mm-hmm.
their problems. And with Violet, I mean, her husband just up and died on her before she
yeah,
had the chance to
bastard.
Divorce him. She was like, how come he died before I had the chance to divorce him? So she, even there, like,
yeah.
he put her in an awkward position, even though probably he didn't mean to die. But... Who knows?
Who knows? He could have been a spiteful asshole
could
who was
been.
Like, ha-ha.
He sounded not great, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, just, like, a whole bunch of duds, like, across the board. So I feel like Dwayne, like, Dorley's husband, is actually, like, kind of the best of the bad bunch just because he's around so little.
Yeah.
Which isn't saying much. But, yeah, it sort of, like, goes from, like active menace, like Frank, mm-hmm. to sort of like then gradients of, like, you know, slightly less offensive, still irritating, you know, like down mm-hmm. the board. At no point are they, like, actively good or supportive.
No, these women cannot escape. They're surrounded by duds.
Yeah, which is also really interesting for, like, the workplace itself having all these women congregate in the middle sort of, like, you know, bullpen area.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of, like, the dudes' offices are sort of, like, around the fringe.
Yes.
Or sort of, like, above them, I guess, also. Yeah. So they're literally, like, hemmed in
mm-hmm.
by dudes that are getting paid much more than them that, you know, probably aren't as experienced as them. Totally guessing, but, like,
yeah.
But, like, they're
more
literally confined. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Seems right.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're sort of all, yeah, like, trapped together
mm-hmm.
within that,
like, corralled.
Literally,
yeah. And it just popped into my head actually too when Violet is installing the garage door opener in her garage, her son is with her, and she's kind of lamenting that she didn't get this raise or this promotion. And at one point, her son even tells her to calm down about it. Her son is like, you're thinking about it too much, or you're worrying about it too much, and, like, offers her some pot,
mm-hmm.
which seems like, oh, that's cool. Like, they have a good relationship. But he's also kind of trying to...
Placate her
and get her to...
Rather than address the problem, which is,
yeah,
like...
sexism.
Yeah.
So even in that sort of lovely mother-son relationship,
yeah.
it's like, oh, he's just telling her to be quiet
be
and
quiet.
Make
be
herself
smaller.
Yeah. And float away. Yeah, it's really insidious.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Which also is interesting that the revenge fantasies are so melodramatic.
Yeah.
Because, like, there's all this, like, tamped downness happening. Like, be quieter, be smaller, be contained. Mm-hmm. Don't react. And these revenge fantasies are, like, insane.
Mm-hmm.
They're so over the top. They're so dramatic. Judy's is like this like nightmarish vision of
safari
like
hunter,
a safari hunter in the darkened office.
Yeah.
The office lesbian is carrying an axe for some reason. There's dogs. Stuff is like, it's weird. She then mounts Frank's head on like a wall. Mm-hmm. And I think Dora Lee's is actually like the most unsettling because it seems.
Mm-hmm.
The most realistic, quote unquote. Like,
she's directly like changing roles.
Yes. Yeah.
While adding a little cowgirl spin.
Yeah. But their dialogue is sort of the most, like, the least absurd thing in that scenario, I guess. I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And it is sort of played for laughs, but it is, like, quite upsetting.
Very, yeah.
It's also, like, very startling to hear a man objectified.
Yes.
Like that. So, also, there's sort of, like, a bracing, like, whoa. Like, it's, like, again, even now, we're, like, so unused to hearing something, like, a woman tell a man, like, oh, you've got a great package, you should show it off.
Yeah. When she gets him to turn around, and she says, I just wanted to check your bod.
Mm-hmm.
Even that, like, he gets her to turn around, and she's like, is there something on my dress? What's going on? Mm-hmm. And with her, she has that confidence, but it sounds wrong, because we're not used to hearing someone in her position, or even a non-man objectify someone like that.
Yeah.
And he's embarrassed.
Yeah.
Right? He blushes. He looks like he's gonna cry. He's like, oh, you know, please don't talk like that. I'm a happily married man. And it's just, this role reversal is very unsettling.
Yeah.
And I think it's, you're right, played for laughs, but underneath it's also kind of a challenge to ask us why we feel so much more uncomfortable.
Yeah, totally. You know what actually it reminded me of? The Lady Ghostbusters, that no one saw except for you and me.
Yeah.
that weird dynamic in that movie where the Kristen Wiig character keeps, like, objectifying the Chris Hemsworth character.
Mm-hmm.
And how that's always sort of, like, also played for a joke. But, like, she is saying some horrifying things to him.
Horrifying, yeah.
And that sort of, like, stuck out as the one other sort of, like, instance that I could immediately recall in, you know, recent cinema where that kind of role reversal happened. And with the Ghostbusters movie, it seemed less knowing. Like, it seemed more straightforwardly just like, oh, how silly is this?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than like, oh, we're making a point about something.
In Ghostbusters, it's like, Chris Hemsworth is hot, right?
We can all agree.
Yeah.
She's just saying it.
She's just saying what we're all thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, even though it was like deeply ick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, so, but I think in this context, they are much more knowing.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it's, a, like, and again, such a, like, taboo subject. Like, women, like, assaulting or harassing men is such a much more narrow representative.
Yeah, which group. Is not to say it doesn't happen, but it's so much rarer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's, and we're so used to men saying these things to women that it's almost harder to notice.
Exactly. It's much more, like, normalized.
Yeah.
So I think that was the other thing, is like, when it is reversed, we notice how much more brutal it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it is so new.
Yeah.
Even though it's like the same things.
Yeah. Well, even the point of view shots, like when he's harassing Dora Lee, we get these point of view shots of her cleavage. Mm-hmm. And I just think of how much has been made throughout history of Dolly Parton's breast size. Mm-hmm. And just how how much breasts and Dolly Parton sort of seem to be synonymous. Mm-hmm. Or yeah, you think Dolly Parton, you think big boobs, you think big boobs, you think Dolly Parton. Which, I mean, she's spoken a lot about how, like, that's her choice and she's happy with them and, you mm-hmm. know. But the fact that it almost seems so commonplace to even look at someone's cleavage.
Yeah.
And especially if that person is Dolly Parton. It's like, oh, well, that's, I mean, she got big boobs, so people could look at her cleavage. Which is not necessarily the case, and definitely not Dora Lee's story.
Yeah.
If we're thinking about the character. But we're so used to looking at cleavage. Whereas when somebody says, ooh, I like your package, it's like, ooh. What? Who says that? But it's a sort of, yeah, inverse, I guess.
Well, Frank got a great package.
That sounds so gross.
Package also isn't a sexy word, though.
It's not a sexy word. No.
It sounds like something you get in the mail. You're like, your package is here.
Yeah.
Ooh. Ooh. Is it?
Leave it on the counter.
What?
I don't know. I'm very tired.
I just want to quickly talk about how interesting the ending is and the twist for when there's sort of like the final. So we think that we're watching this movie where the women get the upper hand because they're able to get blackmail material on Frank.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out, oh no, that's not going to be the case because he's able to sort of cover his tracks well enough. But then what ends up being the real reason that they like triumph or succeed or whatever is simply the fact that they are like better workers.
Yeah.
Like they are making themselves more valuable within the system itself.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore there's a calculation that's made to sort of like keep them as is and remove Frank.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than like disrupt that. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know how much further to take it beyond that, but I just felt like it was really interesting that like the reason that these women succeed is just that like they're really good gosh darn workers.
Yeah.
In the company, and the company that was perfectly happy to oppress them before now is like, oh well, you know, like good job. Thank you for doing this extra work for us.
Mm-hmm.
We're happy to give you these allowances sort of like after the fact, now that you've proven that you are going to like, not that your like lives are better, but that you're doing more for us.
Yeah. Well, I think that extends to all the women, right? The women who are taking advantage of the part-time work and the daycare and mm-hmm. all of that stuff. Like they're better workers because of those allowances, mm-hmm. even though Frank has already taken credit for those allowances. So yeah. They don't even get credit where it's due. So as far as the top brass is concerned, yeah, these women are just good at working. They're not innovative.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's, I would love to have seen them just sort of burn it down.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I also appreciate that they all still need those jobs.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing where it's like, okay, if we have to be in this system, we might as well make it our system, mm-hmm. or make it as humane as possible. And so that could mean, you know, putting a picture of your kid on your desk and not getting trouble for it. Or it could mean having a daycare where you can actually go to work and, you know, take your kid home with you at the end of the day. But yeah, it's, I think, yeah, like, I think it's interesting because the movie is a comedy and it does include fantasy aspects. And so I think the expected thing would be for the movie to have a sort of more fantasy ending beyond Frank being sent to Brazil. But I like that it's still grounded in the reality that these women still need to work and they need to work somewhere.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's like no sense like showing them somehow, you know, fixing capitalism.
Yeah, because I think
like these are the small allowances that make life bearable within capitalism, I guess is what you're saying.
Yeah, well, and we see at the in the end credits we see like Dorley became a country and western singer, ha, right, ha,
yeah,
ha,
ha, ha.
And you know, like they all kind of move on, mm-hmm. but at the same time too, like, Violet worked hard for her job.
Yeah.
Like she worked her way up in that company and she has four kids to support and yeah. So it seems realistic in a movie that is realistic while also kind of pretending not to be.
Yeah, it's sort of like a oddly sober turn, actually.
Yeah.
In the end.
Yeah.
After all the zaniness that's gone before.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a good balance. Mm-hmm. Like, that's one of the things I love about this movie is it's so absurd, but it's grounded in experience and truth. Like, it's making fun of things a lot of us know to be absolutely true.
Oh, it feels very, yeah, it's very resonant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like this is, so we're sort of like leaping into theme corner now. Did you have anything else we want to talk about before talking about office stuff more broadly?
Well, did you want to talk more about Frank as boss?
I think we'll cover that maybe in theme corner.
Okay.
Just thinking about, again, the project of office movies and what they're doing for us, what they're validating for us or challenging in us. And I feel like the impulse for me is always the burn it down impulse.
Of, yeah.
Like, get rid of it. Like start again, you know, try something better. 'cause that's where I'm at.
Yeah.
But thinking about it in contrast to the heist movies that we've also talked about, where that also was kind of the impulse. They're like, burn it down, you know, steal a bunch of money, retire somewhere.
Yeah.
So I guess the trick is then finding the middle ground between it, like something tenable, something sustainable, something livable. That you can build a life on. While also imagining things that aren't, like, so oppressive you want to die.
Yeah.
Important. Yeah. So anyways, that's a ramble to get to the point where I basically just think my impulse always in watching these office movies is to be like, you know, like, destroy the company.
Mm-hmm. Capitalism must lose.
Just anarchy, essentially. Yeah, yeah. And then I'm always a little bit bummed when it's like, oh, and everyone goes back to work on Monday.
Yeah.
But also, like, that's the reality, and that's, like, my reality, and that's, you know, everyone's reality.
Well, and I think, like, again, I think one thing I will say for them going back to work is that it seems to be genuinely a better place to work and a more humane place. I mean, one of the things that really strikes me is at the end, or toward the end, when they're clearly taking over the office, we see a lot more people of color. We see disabled people working. We see just a broader spectrum of workers, which suggests that workers that have been previously sort of barred from doing those jobs are now welcome.
Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah, good point. Also, yeah, like a wheelchair user.
Mm-hmm.
Which I feel like in general, again, so rarely see in films people using wheelchairs.
Much less in a film made in 1980.
Yeah. And then also in an office where there's a very sort of prescribed, like, this is the body that fits in the office, you know? Mm-hmm. Even though that's bullshit, obviously. But yeah. Like, but there's like that sort of cookie cutter aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they open up the office to make it easier to get around, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. They reconfigure the desks and everything, too. They reconfigure the desks.
Yeah. So it's not a matter of people, wheelchair users don't fit in offices. Mm-hmm. It's very clear that they're saying offices often don't make room for wheelchair users.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not actually the body's problem. It's
the space's problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
The design of the space. Design of
the space. Yeah. Which, yeah, again, I'm astonished that was even considered in a movie made in 1980.
That there's a subtext of a movie. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cause it seems like something that somebody would do now and really congratulate themselves for being so woke. Mm-hmm. Like it's really astonishing.
Yeah, a lot of things felt like revolutionary, even watching now, like the job sharing program mm-hmm. of like, oh yeah, like so and so comes to work in the morning and then someone else takes their desk in the afternoon and they both work part time and they both love it and they're both like thriving in this arrangement.
Well, and even the whole central problem, which is that Violet accidentally poisons the coffee. The problem is the packaging is too similar to his favorite sweeteners packaging. And so the problem is marketing and capitalism, right? It was capitalism all along. It's like the yellow box with the red thing on it. Like,
yeah.
And because also she does it in front of another colleague. Mm-hmm. Like that colleague doesn't notice
either.
They
don't even clock it.
So it's like the problem is this sort of robotic way that we just sort of reach for things and assume
structures
will be there for us and you know turns out it might be something else.
Or yeah, they're just like very simple things that you can do to like imagine yourself out of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Can't remember if we talked about this last time, but what, in thinking now about office movies in general, what do you think are sort of like key themes that we're seeing?
Bad bosses.
And that's Frank.
That is Frank. And the higher-ups. Mm-hmm. And Roz. Depressing office culture.
Mm-hmm. Hierarchy. But what makes it depressing?
Oh, just like the rows of desks or the grage or the, mm-hmm. I mean, in 9 to 5, it's nobody can have anything on their desks.
Yeah.
In office space, it's the TPS reports and the just sort of lackadaisical everything.
And also the like configuration of the desks and that, like in 9 to 5. The problem is that everything feels too open. Mm-hmm. And in office space, the cubicles are too enclosed.
Yeah. Yeah, and I noticed actually in the office redesign in 9 to 5, they have cubicles, but they're sort of only half cubicles. They're more like corners here and there.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of privacy, but it's not, they're not shut off.
Yeah.
From everywhere
else. You don't
feel
claustrophobic when you're inside one.
And they're like orange and yellow, and so.
Yeah. Nice break.
Nice bright colors. There's a certain element in office movies, or at least the ones we've seen, where nobody is really happy.
Yeah.
There. Like, it's work is a job you have to do. Mm-hmm. And it takes too much work to find another job. So you just have to sort of.
And most other jobs would be too similar to, like, that's sort of like. Yeah. Like, it's just more of the same.
Totally. Unless you make a huge career change and take a huge risk that I mean people are afraid to do that for very good reasons.
So you need to already have the resources to do it.
Mm-hmm. So. It's a privilege to be able to quit your job and do something new.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we've got bad bosses. We've got, and bad of a particular flavor. Mm-hmm. So it's like the sneaky, like, I'm your leader kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The wanting to be sort of like chummy and then also sort of enforcing things at the same time.
And completely ineffectual.
Mm-hmm. Never really knows what's going on. But particularly the double bind of like wanting to be pals and also wanting to be in charge at the same time.
Yeah, sort of being the office cop.
Mm-hmm.
Playing both good cop and bad cop. Because even when he meets Judy, when Frank meets Judy, he kind of makes a pass at her.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the Xerox room, he yells at her.
Yeah.
And essentially treats her like she is
a child.
A child who is about to be fired.
Yeah.
Whereas just before, he tells her how pretty she is and how happy they are that they have a new girl. And like, it's so gross. It's very two-faced.
Mm-hmm.
And neither reaction is appropriate.
What? You don't condone either. All right.
Very good. I do not condone either. I will go on the record.
Oh, strong words from Mandy Elliott.
Yeah, that's my hot take.
Wow. Yeah, and I think also the sense that when you're in the office, there's sort of like no outside world, or the outside world sort of gets narrower.
Mm-hmm.
There's one point in this movie where Judy like comes back into the office after being there the day before, which is how it works.
Yeah,
but she is clocking in and says, right. Oh, I feel like I was just here a minute ago. And another worker, but just behind her, is like, oh, you know, I know how you feel, but you'll get used to it eventually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this, so the sense that like once you start working, that kind of becomes your life.
Yes. And conversely, if you leave that life in the middle of the day, you become some sort of superhero.
Mm-hmm.
So like an office space when, I can't remember the protagonist's name, but when he kind of comes and goes as he pleases, it's like,
Peter Gibbons,
what a rock star.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when Violet and Judy and Doralee all storm out of the office, there's this
to go to Charlie's?
This one woman who just goes, that a girl. Like every time they leave
the office,
like,
lesbian.
They're like, I gotta go. And she's like, that a girl. And she's also the office drunk, who gets sober as soon as Frank leaves, basically. because she feels the life is worth living. But yeah, she's just very, she looks very wistfully at them. She's like, not a girl.
Yeah, there's something like, inspiring about
it. Yeah, because they just decide, they're like, I don't have to stay here and take this. And there really aren't any consequences for them to go day drinking when they should be at work.
Mm-hmm.
But that little affirmation
from
the employee who doesn't really pay attention to anything else kind of suggests that they're heroes for daring to leave the oppressive workplace.
I mean, yeah, them going to Charlie's to drink is like the equivalent of Peter and pals going to that tchotchkes place.
Yeah.
For an extended mid-morning coffee.
Yeah. And the women smoking pot at Doralee's is like when they beat up the copy machine in Office Space. It's a transgression that leads to a plan.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, printers. Everyone hates them. Another through line.
Yeah.
They're always out to get you.
Because they always break.
And they're always in the middle of, like, some complex job that takes forever and you just gotta watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No good.
No good.
All right. Shall we move on to moments of joy?
Sure.
What were your moments of joy?
Well, I did like it when Office Lesbian says "atta girl" three times. I really like that when they're in the restaurant and Violet brings out the joint or the marijuana cigarette, Doralee says, "Is that a marijuana cigarette?" And Violet says, "Shush." And you think she doesn't want to get caught with it, but she says, "There isn't enough to go around." Like, she doesn't want to have to share with any more people than she has to. And I love that.
Pretty good.
And I also love that Judy calls it marijuana.
Oh, Judy. Which is just bless Judy. She's so, so sweet and naive.
Yeah, she also says to Dick, her ex-husband, who thinks she's a floozy now, she says, if I want to have an affair or play sex games or do M&Ms, I can. And it's terrific. And then, of course, the crown jewel is we got another stiff in the John.
Oh, perfect.
But really, this whole movie brings me so much joy.
This movie is a treat.
It really is.
You know what? It's 2 hours, and I wouldn't trim half an hour to make it a tight 90. I would not.
That is the highest praise.
Yeah.
Folks, the highest praise.
Everything is perfect about it. Mm-hmm. Everything is great. I think, I've already talked about how much I love Frank, because Frank's a weirdo. This is like a real problem with me, I think, is like my favorite character in Office Space was the boss. But really, I'm a class betrayer. I'm not as anarchic as I hope to be. I'm trying. I just have daddy issues, you know? So one of my moments of joy was when Frank is trying to, you know, harass/seduce Doralee, and also it's a terrible time. But she has like the best insults that are just so like oof oof. At one point she's like, I've been chased by swifter men than you, yes. And I ain't being caught yet.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh man, you're just like in one sentence saying, you're not all that.
Yeah.
You think you are, but you're not. Better men have tried and failed. Just like saying, oh yeah, like you're not that fast and also you're not that smart. Like, God, it's just oof, vicious. I love it.
All with a big smile on her face.
Yeah. Also like while looking so friendly and nice.
Yeah.
Just nuts.
Oh.
Super good. Yeah. But then also just like I think Frank, like just Dabney Coleman's a great actor, but like the way that he's able to look panicked while grinning maniacally at the same time,
yes,
like really was like, I don't know, incredible. So like at one point, and then he just like does these very idiosyncratic things that just make me laugh hysterically. So in Doralee's fantasy, when she's like, unbutton your shirt and loosen up, he like sort of like starts unbuttoning his shirt and then does like this like incredible little like sort of shrug as if he's trying to like sort of shake, like get loose, but he like also doesn't know how to move his body.
Yeah.
It's the most amazing thing I've seen.
Oh, amazing.
And then at another point, Doralee like pushes his face into her tits.
Yes.
And he's so grumpy.
It's like the last place he wants his face to be.
Just like, he looks like a grumpy little boy with a giant mustache.
Slightly balding.
And then at the end when the chairman is congratulating him on, like, the open plan and, like, reconfigurating the office, he has this moment where he just, like, has this little giggle that, like, sort of stops abruptly. And again, just, like, made me laugh so hard. It's, like, not funny to, like, explain, but it's just, like, I don't know. It's his delivery.
Yeah, he's really embracing all aspects of his character.
Oh, like, he looks the so absurd.
And then in all of the fantasy scenes, like, he's just really, he gives it.
He's really going for it. Yeah. And then when he's, like, tied up in the house and has to get yoinked around by the garage door puller thing, like, I don't know, he's really giving it.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, even the whole thing about being tied up in the house to the garage door opener. I mean, it's rigged and it looks like some sort of S&M gone wrong.
It does.
Which I'm sure is on purpose.
I'm very happy about it.
And like at one point he's gagged with the scarf that he gives Doralee and his wife finds him like that. Like they put him on this thing so that he can go to the bathroom and move around the room. But it's also, they can click the garage door opener and send him flying up to the ceiling. And it's great. He's just in a harness the whole time.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful.
Yeah, truly.
Okay, I have two more things.
Okay.
Very quickly. So when they're in the hospital and Violet is overhearing the cop and the doc talk to each other, just like the doc's delivery of his lines were also just like, mwah, yes, delicious. So the hospital cop is like talking about the dude that just died. He's like, well, how is he, doc? And the doc's like, oh, he's dead. Your bedside manners. Oh, that's dead. Yeah.
Yeah, he's dead.
It's like, what the fuck?
Oh.
Like, we don't hear anything more from him, but just that was a beautiful moment. And then later on in the hospital, when Violet is like losing her mind and pushing the gurney around, at one point, Judy is like talking to a hospital staff, and Doralee's with her, and Judy just turns to Doralee and is like, oh, how's Violet? And as the moment, like, Violet is pushing a gurney past them, and Doralee is like, oh, honey, I think Violet is flipped out.
Yes. It's
also just like, mwah.
And Lily mwah. Tomlin is so excellent when she's just panicking and pushing a gurney and trying to be cool, but she's so stiff and, like, oh, it's just...
This is amazing. Like, Lily they're Tomlin. All comedic geniuses. Yes. Like, it really is, like, the perfect casting of everything.
It's true. They're all so good, they're and they so work good. So well together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, it's genius. It's genius.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, do you have any movie connections?
Well, I have... You have one that I share.
I have one?
The Apartment.
Oh, The Apartment.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, of course. Explain it, though.
Oh, you want me to explain
yes.
it? Yes. So the company that is at the heart of this movie, Consolidated, which we didn't really talk about the anonymity of the company, much like with the one in Office Space, but this company happens to share a name with the terrible company in The Apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And the desks are laid out very similarly. The office spaces are very, like, it must be a nod.
It feels like the same building,
yeah,
honestly.
Yeah, it must be.
Yeah.
It must be. But yeah, just the desks everywhere. And so it feels very modeled on The Apartment.
Yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, what a good office movie, The Apartment.
Truly. Yeah, and then just, you know, every other office movie that has a terrible boss and a depressing atmosphere. But this one really makes it different,
mm-hmm.
I think, in a lot of ways.
I have two very, very different connections. One was, I was just like nearing the end of my watch and thinking, in a slightly different light, this could be A Christmas Carol.
Oh, yeah.
Right, where Frank is Scrooge.
I see that.
And all three women are like ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future, just like congregating on him.
Yep.
Forcing him to do better.
I can definitely see that.
Like, just like a few tweaks. Not yeah. even that many. And this would be A Christmas Carol.
Huh.
But also would then refocus the story on Frank
yes,
rather than on the women.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, that was
would still be a story about toxic masculinity.
Oh yeah. Of course. Well, I mean, yeah. That's tale as old as time.
Yes. True.
And then the other one actually was one I referenced earlier, Mr. Mom. Have you seen Mr. Mom?
Oh, not for years and
okay,
years.
It is genuinely a delightful film.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. I enjoyed the heck out of it. Michael Keaton looks approximately 12.
I love Michael Keaton.
And he's like a father, but he looks way too, like, he looks like a little boy. It's quite funny. Anyways, I was thinking about how that film also does sort of like a reversal of this film's project, where this film is showing like women entering the workforce, and Mr. Mom is sort of showing the reverse of it, where it's like men entering the domestic home and doing domestic labor, and validating domestic labor as labor.
Right.
So sort of just showing the mundanity of that and the joys of that. And, you know, so thinking about Mr. Mom and 9 to 5 is sort of like an interesting pairing.
Yeah. Well, especially given one of the things that I just thought.
And they came out very similar in time also.
Yeah. Well, 9 to 5 makes a big point, especially at the beginning. All of the people rushing off to work are women running in heels and like nylons and trying to fit in coffee and trying to get their kids off to school and trying to do all of these things that count as domestic labor while on their way out into the workforce. So the movie is very clear too that it's not one or the other for some people.
Yeah.
Right? It's both and.
That's right. Yeah.
But yeah, I love that Mr. Mom actually treats domestic labor as labor. Because that's so... I mean, in Mrs. Doubtfire, it's sort of like a fluffy, fun thing. And there are lots of problems with Mrs. Doubtfire. But yeah, I'll have to rewatch Mr. Mom.
Mm-hmm. Do it. Do it. It's a romp. At one point, the ladies of the neighborhood, all the other moms, take the Michael Keaton character to a male strip club.
What?
Yeah.
Awesome.
So, you know what? It's like something for everyone, honestly. Yeah. Super great. Okay, what did we learn? And juiciest bits, juiciest butts. I think you know what my juiciest butt is.
I think I do. What did we learn? I learned to be really careful when putting sweetener in someone else's coffee.
Oh, always look at the box.
Always look at the box.
Yeah.
Yeah, good advice.
And if a little skull and crossbones floats out of the cup,
yeah,
you know you did a bad job.
Don't drink it.
Yeah.
Only give it to your very worst boss.
Also, if poison doesn't get him, tossing him out a window will.
Yeah. That's the old double
whammy. It's always
whammy.
Good to have a backup plan.
Always have a backup plan. Yes.
When going to assassinate your boss.
When going to assassinate
your boss. Be prepared with contingencies.
Yes. Always check the box. Always have a backup plan.
Make sure the window opens. Mm-hmm. You're in one of those rooms where the windows don't open, which is most offices. Rooms now.
Yeah. And always make sure you know how to install a garage door opener, because you never know when you need those skills.
It is universally handy, apparently. Yeah. Yeah, my God.
You can do it to keep your boss captive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Also, yeah, just like, don't skip workouts, because these ladies were handily able to hogtie this big old man.
Oh. Yeah, so impressive.
Like, yeah. Just keeping it tight.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
And we should all bring back corded phones. Because you never know when you need a phone cord.
That's true.
To tie up someone.
Yeah, that is true.
In sexy or unsexy ways. Just saying.
That's a very good point.
Missed opportunities now.
Get on that iPhone.
Like, this cordless phone is great, but what I would like is actually 20 feet of a long cord.
A retractable cord.
Now you're thinking.
I'm thinking.
Best of both worlds.
Now we're cooking with gas.
Ooh.
Hit me up, Apple.
Amazing. Mm. Yeah. Wonderful. Okay, juiciest butts?
Well, I don't know if I want to objectify anyone's butt after talking about this.
You're taking the high road.
But if I had
Boo.
To.
Get up. You're forced. You're forced.
I mean, Dabney Coleman has a great butt. But Dolly Parton also has a great butt. So I might have to go Dolly Parton.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
It's agreed. Yeah. Both of them together.
Mm-hmm.
So great.
So great.
Also, not enough respect for Dabney Coleman's mustache. My God. Oh.
Yes.
That is a juicy mustache.
It's iconic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I would recognize him without it.
That mustache goes strong even when his hair, like, whitens and falls out.
Yeah.
Like, that mustache, I mean, I think secret to life itself,
yeah.
Honestly.
That man can wear a mustache.
Oh, boy can he.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt about it. Do you have any final thoughts, or shall we bid the listeners adieu?
I have no thoughts.
No thoughts, just vibes.
Just vibes.
Listeners, this is the end of it. This episode, that is. Come back next time when we do our third and final Office movie.
Very exciting.
TBD. Mm-hmm. We've chosen it, but we're not telling you. Yeah, it's You've got to wait. All right. I've been Charlie.
I've been Maddie.
See y'all later.
Bye.